I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Well, I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a moment in American history that I think resonates in some ways with our times today and the continued argument over America's place in the world, what it is and what it should be. I'm joined for that conversation today by someone who I suspect is very well known to many, if not all of our listeners, Professor H.W. Brands. Professor Brands is the Jack S. Blanton Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin. He is one of the preeminent scholars of American history, a terrific biographer. Many of our listeners will know his books on Ronald Reagan, on the Founding Fathers, on Andrew Jackson, Benjamin Franklin, and Franklin Roosevelt. His book on Roosevelt, by the way, has one of the best titles of any American historical biography, A Traitor to His Class. I love that title. It's terrific. And today we're going to be talking about a book with another great title, apropos for our time, America First, Roosevelt versus Lindbergh, in the Shadow of War. H.W. Brands, thank you for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Glad to be with you.
This book, you argue in many ways, of course, the title America First is so immediate for our time. The argument you make in the book that it is in many ways, Roosevelt and Lindbergh are the important personalities, but they're also representatives of different views of America that are important in the mid 20th century. Can you talk about the context, the setting of this clash between Franklin Roosevelt and Charles Lindbergh?
Sure. So the question that's debated in my book, and I focus on the period from the 1st of September, 1939, when Germany invades Poland and starts World War II in Europe, and December 1941, when Japan attacks the United States at Pearl Harbor and brings the United States into the war. So this 2 years and 4 month period is the focus of my debate. And the debate is about whether the United States should enter the war that's going on in Europe. That's the heart of the debate. That's the narrow question. But the broader question is, what should America's role in the world be? Should the United States take notice of, should the United States be worried about the war going on in Europe? There was also a war going on in Asia, but in terms of this debate, that gets very much less attention. Turns out that it's a big deal. But the debate is really all about whether the United States should repeat its experiment, its experience from World War I. So, you ask for the context. From American independence in the 1770s until the 1930s, the United States had taken the position that the troubles of Europe were not America's troubles and that they should steer clear of America's troubles. Now, there was one big exception to this, and this was the American intervention in World War I. But after that intervention had taken place and after the experience turned out to be a bad one from the American point of view, Americans were convinced that the previous policy, to which Americans had been directed by none other than George Washington, who in his farewell address said, "Stay out of the affairs of Europe. Do not form attachments with one country or another. The troubles of Europe or Europe's troubles are not America's troubles." Americans had been very attached to that idea. And for a century and a half, with the exception that I mentioned, they thought that this policy had served America well. In fact, so well that in the 1930s, Congress wrote into law a series of measures called the Neutrality Acts, 1935, 36, 37, that mandated neutrality in case of another war. And they were all thinking of another European war. And these acts specifically prevented the president of the United States, who happened to be Franklin Roosevelt, from taking steps like the steps that Woodrow Wilson had taken during World War I that gradually drew the United States closer and closer into war until war became finally unavoidable. And Congress, backed by the American people, in a bipartisan measure, said, "We're going to avoid that. We thought it was a mistake." And so my story really begins out of this context where Americans are overwhelmingly opposed to the idea of entering another European war should that war break out. Now, the war did break out, and at the very beginning, Americans are opposed. But gradually, Franklin Roosevelt eases the United States toward intervention because Roosevelt was not an outspoken critic of the Neutrality Acts. In fact, as president, he had signed the Neutrality Acts. But underneath that, he was an internationalist at heart. He had believed in the project of Woodrow Wilson in World War I, basically taking the position the United States must be a leader of the world. American interests require it, the interests of the world require it. Roosevelt has said very little about that during the 1930s because he could see which way the political winds were blowing. Americans didn't want to hear that, but in his heart of hearts, that's what he wanted. So he's pushing America away from this longstanding tradition of non-intervention in the affairs of Europe.
Is that tradition a bipartisan tradition? Is it Republicans and Democrats alike that continue to embrace that tradition in the 1930s?
Historically, it had been bipartisan. In the 1930s, it remained bipartisan. Now, there were sort of partisan aspects to it as well. I mean, especially when Roosevelt begins pushing against the neutrality policy, because then he's opposed primarily by Republicans, not by Republicans exclusively. There were members of the Democratic Party who opposed any breakaway from this position of non-intervention. But once Roosevelt basically said, okay, we're moving in the direction of intervention, he continues to say, I'm not talking about sending troops, but sending aid, sending weapons, giving moral support, diplomatic support. Those, the non-interventionists, called by their critics isolationists, they're predominantly Republicans. And of course, they had the Republican incentive to try to stop what a Democratic president was doing. But there were definitely many Democratic non-interventionists as well.
And what about the context of Charles Lindbergh's entry into this debate?
So Lindbergh, he's kind of the strange one here. And you accurately identified that I hang this debate on these two debaters, on my two protagonists. Franklin Roosevelt's an obvious one. He's president of the United States. But Charles Lindbergh, he holds no public office. He was, at the beginning of my story, a colonel in the Air Corps Reserve. So very minor figure in that regard. But he was a celebrity. He was one of America's first celebrities. In 1927, single-handedly, he flew across the Atlantic Ocean. The first time the Atlantic Ocean had been hopped across in a plane in a single flight. And this won a big cash prize. It had been one of the technical challenges of the age. It made Lindbergh not only an American hero, but a celebrity worldwide. And all of a sudden, he was this great figure. For my students, actually, for other people, it doesn't actually apply so much to my students anymore, but I said that Lindbergh was to the 1920s like astronauts were to the 1960s. Now, my students were nowhere near Iran in the 1960s.
Right.
But he was like that. So he had done something that was a technical achievement that required competence, but also bravery. His plane could easily have crashed and he would have died. And so he gets this hero's welcome first in France, where he lands and he's given the Legion of Honor, but he's feted in countries around the world. He's this hero in the United States. But then his story takes a tragic turn that in some ways endears him even more to Americans. He's in the spotlight and he marries and he and his wife have a son, a very cute child, who is tragically kidnapped and murdered. And so all of a sudden, there is this dark cloud that has come on, well, who until then was called Lucky Lindy. And so he has that additional gravitas of the weight of the tragedy. So people are even more interested in him. Now, meanwhile, during all this, so we're going from 1927 to the early 1930s is when the child is killed. And then through the 1930s, as events in Europe particularly, but also in Asia, give indications that the world might be going to war again. And this is hard. This is in two decades after the previous World War. Lindbergh maintains his expertise, in fact, improves his expertise in the knowledge of aircraft design. Because he is such a public figure, because he is so well known, and because he's known to be an expert in aircraft, whenever he visits other countries, which he typically does by flying himself in his own plane, he is invited by the governments there to review their their air forces, and to tell them, so how can we improve these planes? How can we make them go higher and faster and all this other stuff? Because they want to pick his brain. In some ways, they also want to show off what they've got as a way of signaling to potential belligerents, we're ready for this. So Lindbergh knew more about the air forces of the world than anybody else. And because of his continuing attachment with the Army, the War Department, when you come back to Washington, you say, well, I went to Germany and their planes look like this, and I went to France and their planes look like this. But despite all this, he was not simply apolitical, he was anti-political. His father had been a congressman during World War I who had been opposed to American entry in the war there, and he had run afoul of the Wilson administration. In fact, it slapped charges under the Sedition Act against him. His father had been driven out of politics. And Lindbergh, from this, took the lesson that politics is a low, mean business. It's dishonorable, and nobody who really values honesty should get involved. So he is anti-political, but he knows a lot about the machines that will be used in the war. And he, from one brief meeting with Franklin Roosevelt, a personal meeting with Roosevelt, but also just observing Roosevelt, he conceived this opinion that Roosevelt was a fundamentally dishonest character who was not leveling with the American public. Lindbergh believed in his heart of hearts that the United States should defend itself close to home. The best defense for the United States was a robust defense of American shores, indeed, of the shores of North America and South America. Lindbergh was often, well, sometimes he was said to be even a pacifist, and he stoutly resisted that. He said, I'm not a pacifist. I will go to war when American interests are directly challenged, but they're not in Europe. That's Europe's problems. Remember what George Washington said? Let Europe's problems be Europe's problems, not Americans. So he became the spokesman for the anti-Roosevelt, anti-interventionist position.
And that position coined itself, or was coined, America First.
Yeah, it was actually, at the time, it was thought to be a pretty good label, because who can object to the idea of putting America first? Now, it's only in retrospect that America First developed these negative overtones. And the negative overtones came from the fact that the America First people had opposed American entry into the war. The United States did go into the war, and the war turned out very well. So it was possible to read back into the past that, well, they must have been misguided. Or maybe worse than being misguided, maybe they were closet Nazi sympathizers or something. Now, this is a charge that is leveled consistently every time the United States has gone to war. Anybody who opposes the war, whether this was the War of 1812, the Civil War, the Vietnam War, groups that oppose administration policy in the war, somebody connected to the administration or friendly to the administration would say, these are sympathizers with Britain or with the Confederacy or with North Vietnam or something like this. So there were political motives for making these allegations, but that's what happens during wartime. And so because the America Firsters did, before the war, this is critical, before the United States went to war, they opposed entry into the war. Then after the fact, they were labeled as disloyal and stupid and sometimes malign. It's important to note that Lindbergh and pretty much everybody else connected with America First, once the United States was in the war after Japan attacked, they loyally rallied to the arms. Lindbergh volunteered to go into the Air Force again. Roosevelt wouldn't let him. He didn't like the idea of his principal opponent going off and becoming a military hero.
All right. The September of 1939 arrives. So the debate has been building in the United States. As you say, the passage of the Neutrality Acts, Charles Lindbergh is forming a certain view of Franklin Roosevelt as dishonestly leading the American people toward intervention in the war. How does the debate pick up momentum and speed with the German invasion of Poland?
So when German troops invade Poland, then the war has begun. It becomes official a couple of days later when Britain and France declare war on Germany. And this is something important, because Lindbergh points out that Germany didn't declare war on Britain and France. He didn't attack them. They declared war on him first. They declared war because they had given a guarantee to Poland that they would defend Poland if Germany invaded. Anyway, so the war begins, and within 48 hours, Franklin Roosevelt goes to Congress and says, we need to revise the neutrality laws. America needs to be able to sell weapons to the good guy belligerents. Now, simply phrasing it this way indicates that the United States is not really neutral, because, you know, he wouldn't say these are the good guys, but It's clear enough, and it was true at the time, that Americans made a fundamental distinction between Germany and Britain and France. I'll focus on Britain because France surrenders, is defeated early in the war. So it's really Britain against Germany in American thinking. And Americans feel that Britain is in the right and Germany is in the wrong. The debate is really over whether that requires American participation in the war on the side of Britain. But anyway, when Roosevelt says we need to amend the neutrality legislation, then Lindbergh says, hey, wait a minute. That law was passed to keep us from getting involved. You are starting to get us involved. Because that's exactly what happened in World War I when the United States began lending money to the British and the French and then began sending weapons to the British and the French. And sooner or later, you get so much invested that you cannot afford to let that side lose. And that's what's happening again. Roosevelt said, on the contrary, sending weapons to Britain, allowing the British to purchase weapons, will reduce the chances that the United States itself will have to get directly involved. Because if we give the British the arms they need to defend themselves, then they won't need us to defend them. And Lindbergh said, you watch. It's going to be more than this.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country, and they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
I think now many of our listeners, certainly it's a common opinion would be, well, look, of course, FDR's position was the right position. Of course, FDR's position, it would inevitably triumph. Obviously, America was going to enter the war on the side of the good guys. Is that the way it actually stood, however, in 1939, 1940, and early 1941?
Well, it's very interesting. And the short answer, the immediate answer to your question is no, nobody knew how this was going to turn out. So, and once you do know how it's going to turn out, then, okay, it's easy to look back and say, the people who said we shouldn't do the thing that we did, and that turned out to be successful, well, they must be wrongheaded. And they might be wrong-hearted as well. And this was especially true when toward the end of the war, American troops discovered, when they liberated the death camps, the full extent, the full depth of the Nazi evil and the bad things it was doing in Europe. And so it made American intervention, involvement in the war appear all that more necessary, and not simply necessary, but good, morally right. So Americans came away from World War II with the belief that, and for decades after, in some circles still, World War II is known as the good war. And the United States was on the side of good, primarily because the other side was so bad. But one of the things that Lindbergh pointed out, first of all, it's important to note that this phenomenon of the death camps was, it hadn't even started during much of the debate. The Jews in Poland and in parts of Germany were being taken away from their homes, and they were taken into camps. But nobody knew what their fate was going to be. And this only became known for sure toward the end of the war. So there's that. But nobody knew that the war was going to end as decisively and successfully as it would for the United States. Wars sometimes don't turn out that way. And if it turned out differently, then the feeling would have been different. But there's something else, again, and that is that Roosevelt had more in mind than simply winning this war against Germany. He had He was going to successfully complete the Wilsonian project of making the United States the leader of the world. Now, he didn't say that in the debates over whether the United States would enter the European war. He phrased it more narrowly, although he did begin to talk in terms of there is good and evil in the world. They're democracies and they're the dictators, and we're on the side of democracy against the dictators. At which point Lindbergh said, hold on a minute, how democratic is Britain, really? In the United Kingdom, on those islands, it's reasonably democratic, but Britain controls India. It's an imperialist power. And you ask us to defend democracy, ask the Indians how democratic the British colonial government is there. And it got even worse because before the United States got involved, in the summer of 1941, Germany attacked the Soviet Union. And Roosevelt, on his own hook, this was after passage of the Lend-Lease Act, which said the United States was going to basically send the opponents of Germany and Italy and Japan everything they needed to keep fighting. And Roosevelt immediately said, we're going to send this stuff to the Soviet Union. Lindbergh said, wait a minute. That's a communist country. That's not a democratic country. So as of June 1941, Lindbergh says, the president says we're going to defend democracy and the right of self-government, and we are aiding the worst dictatorship in the world. That just doesn't make any sense. So it's an interesting thing. You rightly pointed out that after people know how it turned out, then say, well, we did the right thing. But Lindbergh, in all of this, is predicting what's going to happen if the United States goes into this war. So the first thing he says is, if the United States goes back into Europe, then we'll never get out of Europe. And you know, here we are in the year 2024, and America is still deeply involved in Europe. A second thing that Lindbergh said is that we will be propping up a dictator in the Soviet Union. Well, the Stalin survived the war, and Russia sort of remains America's foe. You know, the Soviet Union was quickly a foe in the Cold War, and Russia is a country that still bothers the United States more than just about any other. But in some ways, Lindbergh's sharpest critique was of Roosevelt and the power he was drawing to himself and to the presidency. Because in every one of these changes to the Neutrality Act, there was essentially a clause that would say, and the person who will decide whether these conditions are met that trigger X, Y, or Z is the president of the United States. So when the president decides that sending weapons to somebody is in American interest, it goes ahead. When the president decides this is going to happen, then this will ensue. And so Roosevelt and Lindbergh said, we are making the American president into precisely what he says we're supposed to be fighting against in Europe. He didn't very often use the term dictator to apply to Roosevelt, but he did say that the president is gathering great power to himself. And this became very sharply demarcated in 1940, when Roosevelt ran for a third term as president. Now, strictly speaking, it was not unconstitutional to do so, but it shattered norms of a century and a half's standing. Two terms had been enough for George Washington, and ever after, two terms had been enough for any president. Then Roosevelt comes along and says, no, two terms is not enough for me. He claimed the duress of the emergency in Europe. But in Lindbergh's thinking, the war in Europe was really Roosevelt's excuse for running a third term, not really the cause of it. And so, I mean, it's striking when I was researching this story, and Lindbergh wrote a diary in which he really was revealing his own thoughts. And when he writes about, as I said, he met once personally with Roosevelt. And coming out of this meeting, he said, I can see why people found him so charming. I wanted to be charmed, but I just thought there was more to it than that. And in fact, the reason Roosevelt had invited Lindbergh to the White House was to try to get Lindbergh to join the administration. Roosevelt knew that Lindbergh was skeptical, and he hoped he could bring Lindbergh into the administration and thereby basically silence the criticism. And Lindbergh says, no, I'm not going to do that.
It clearly, in 1939, 1940, the America First position of Lindbergh held enormous power in American public opinion. And this is something that you document in with great care. And I would also say with great sympathy, which I thought was very important in the book. taking this position as seriously as it took itself. You also, though, show kind of how over time FDR successfully began to move and push people and began to win the debate against Lindbergh. How did that happen?
Well, the first thing I have to say is there has never been a more adept politician in the White House than Franklin Roosevelt. And he was good at the one-on-one stuff with speaking to members of Congress, but he was even better at recasting American thinking. It was Roosevelt who pioneered the direct-to-voters communications of the fireside chats. And he did this during the Great Depression, where he was focusing on economics and bank recovery and all this. But he used it in this debate over America's role in the world. He persuaded Americans that America could really be a great country, that it had this larger mission, that what happened in the world abroad was of great interest and importance to Americans. Now, one of the things that was happening and was making his argument the more persuasive was that as soon as the war breaks out in Europe in 39, then all of a sudden the American economy begins to improve, because first Britain and France begin buying lots of American stuff, and then the U.S. Army itself, the U.S. government, begin preparing for war. So Roosevelt had been a depression president until then, but all of a sudden he becomes a prosperity president. Now, he doesn't harp on this. He doesn't say, well, because war is good for the American economy, we should go to war. But he's saying that America is a great country. America can do what it sets its mind to do. I should point out here that one of the things that made the neutrality laws in the mid-1930s so persuasive was that Americans were feeling poor because they were in the middle of this depression. And the feeling was, in the middle of the depression, we got to focus on what's going on here and preference to what's going on abroad. But by 1940, when this debate really heats up, the American economy is basically back to full employment. And Americans have money in their pockets. And instead of having great uncertainty regarding the future and pessimism and a lack of confidence, they've got all the opposite. And so when Roosevelt says, this is a great country, we can guide the destiny of the world, Americans begin to think, hey, you know, maybe we can. So Roosevelt deeply flattered the American people by saying, we can lead the world. And I would suggest that the argument that Roosevelt made then is essentially the argument that American presidents inclined to lead America into some new area of the world. You know, we're going to save Southeast Asia from communism, or we're going to take democracy to the Middle East or something like that. Those presidents are playing on the Roosevelt precedent of America is the greatest country on earth, and we can shape the world in all these good and positive ways.
In 1940, in the election, as you mentioned before, this Roosevelt runs for an unprecedented third term. Opinion has begun to shift toward a more interventionist view. It's not decided yet, of course. Tell us a little bit about the election of 1940 and Lindbergh's place in that election.
So it's very interesting because the election of 1940 is in some ways the most recent until now, and actually until 2024, the most recent election in which voters had a choice about America's role in the world. And because it was clearly at the heart of whether Franklin Roosevelt should be given a third term. But the issue is complicated a bit because Roosevelt's actual opponent, the Republican Wendell Willkie, didn't differ dramatically with Roosevelt regarding the narrow things that Roosevelt wanted to do at that point. He was in favor of aid to Britain and so on. And so if you would simply listen to the debate between Roosevelt and Willkie, there wasn't that much to distinguish them, which is one of the reasons that Roosevelt managed to get elected again, third time. But the spokesman for the real opposition was Charles Lindbergh. So Roosevelt gives what amount to campaign speeches, and Lindbergh gives, they're not exactly campaign speeches because he's not saying vote for Willkie, but he is saying watch out, because if this guy gets elected, I mean, he said if Roosevelt gets elected a third time, he'll probably run for a fourth term. And if he gets elected, then, you know, we're going to be, if Roosevelt wins in 1940, we're going to be electing a president for life. Now, In fact, that's exactly how things turned out. Roosevelt did die in office in 1945. So Lindbergh found himself in this, what to him was a very frustrating position of predicting these things that were going to happen, that Roosevelt was saying were not going to happen. And then one by one, they came true. So Roosevelt's subsequent actions proved Lindbergh right. But Roosevelt kept winning the argument, kept winning the debate. And Lindbergh, in some ways, Lindbergh was a man out of his time, because Lindbergh's approach to the world would have suited him and the country very well in the mid-19th century. In the 19th century, Americans were more than happy for Europe to be far away and for them to have nothing to do with it. And it wasn't simply a political view. Lindbergh, strangely, ironically, didn't like cities. He didn't like modernity. Again, it's ironic because he's flying the most modern planes. He's
right.
Technology. But he's, and the funny, and it's really funny because very often he has these feelings. He hates modernity when he's up in a plane and he's flying along and he's looking down and says, oh, I remember an earlier time. And, you know, he's the beneficiary of all the stuff that modernity can bring, but he's complaining about it all the time. So, you know, we humans are complicated creatures.
They met once, as you said, Lindbergh and Roosevelt. But then there is the campaign of 1940, and then there's the increasing movement toward war, as you document so beautifully in the book, over 40 and 41. Does it ever get personal between them, either in public or private?
It gets very personal, because throughout all of this, Lindbergh believes that he is simply exercising his right as a citizen of the United States under the First Amendment to speak his mind regarding policy. But increasingly, Roosevelt himself, but also members of Roosevelt's administration, are calling Lindbergh a traitor. They're calling him disloyal. They're calling him a fifth columnist. This was a term that originated during this time.
And saying it publicly? Are they saying it privately?
Yes, they're saying it in public. Now, in public for Roosevelt, he doesn't say it in a public speech. But what he does is he holds news conferences, press conferences, and he speaks off the record. But it's kind of off the record, but on the record. The rules then are, first of all, these weren't broadcast, not like news conferences today. So they weren't broadcast, but the reporters would come into Roosevelt's office and he would gather them around. They'd ask questions and he'd tell them stuff. And he increasingly referred to Lindbergh as a copperhead. Now, copperhead was the term for a northerner during the Civil War who supported the Confederacy. So the enemy within. And Roosevelt uses the term disloyal. And when he says, okay, Lindbergh is like a copperhead, then reporters say, can we quote you on that? He said, you can quote me on that. And members of Roosevelt's administration put it even more sharply. They say, this man is a stooge for the Nazi government. This man is disloyal to the United States. And Lindbergh felt rather badly used by all of this because, again, he's thinking, I'm simply speaking my mind. We're not at war. So you can't be disloyal. You can't be a traitor if the country's not at war. I'm simply doing what a citizen has the right to do. And Lindbergh saw that he had an obligation to do this. He believed that the country was going down the wrong path. And he thought, as a good citizen of the United States, I'm in a position where people will listen to me. And the reason that Lindbergh became the spokesman he did was he was a celebrity. And when he asked the news network, the radio networks, if he could have some airtime, they were happy to do it because people would listen, they could sell ads, and everybody would be happy. And so he became this kind of inadvertent spokesman for this position. And he thought, I have to speak my mind because I think we're going to do this disastrous thing.
Well, it is one of the remarkable things about your book that you point out, and I think argue very persuasively, that Lindbergh, even though he was a very famous celebrity, was not driven in his argument with Roosevelt primarily by seeking celebrity himself, but out of a real true conviction.
Yeah. In fact, he realized that making these speeches was going to cause him psychological suffering. He didn't like this. He did not like the attention, but he felt he had an obligation to do it. He was accused by some of Roosevelt's following, and maybe Roosevelt himself suspected this, that Lindbergh really wanted to run for president, wanted to be president of the United States. Well, that was the last thing on Lindbergh's mind. He was repeatedly asked by Republicans if he would run for office. He said, no, this is a terrible thing. And maybe this is a case of Roosevelt projecting onto Lindbergh his own way of thinking. People, they tend to do this. And so, but also it was politically useful for Roosevelt's allies to impute these kinds of self-interested political motives to Lindbergh. Of course, he's going to say this because he just wants to undermine our president. But in fact, Lindbergh would much have preferred staying entirely out of the political realm.
The attack, of course, on Pearl Harbor, as you've mentioned already, changes the debate entirely. What happens with Charles Lindbergh on December 8th, 1941, and going forward?
So, in fact, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor ends the debate. It just silences all opposition because now the United States is at war. Interestingly, Lindbergh had sort of foreshadowed what his reaction might be because he found himself, this is in the summer of 1941, he found himself engaged in politics, which he didn't like, and he was arguing this position against the president of the United States, and it brought all this negative attention. And furthermore, he considered himself an activist at heart, whereas the position he was arguing is, let's not do anything. So it's the opposite of an activist position. And at one point, and he writes in his diary, boy, just from a personal emotional level, I wish I could be supporting a war that I was in favor of and getting involved in a war that I was in favor of rather than opposing a war that I think is foolish. So once the war came, Lindbergh says, we've had our differences until now. My country is at war. I will fight. So he volunteered to fight. But Franklin Roosevelt wouldn't accept his offer. And Roosevelt, there was maybe some argument that given the fact that he had been so opposed to the war, that maybe he wouldn't be credible as an officer. Probably some of it had to do with the fact that Roosevelt's own administration, Roosevelt himself, had cast dark aspersions on Lindbergh's loyalty. So is that going to make a good officer? But a very deeper level is almost certainly the case that the last thing Roosevelt wanted was for his sharpest critic to go off and become a military hero. Boy, what do you do about that? I should say though, Lindbergh volunteered and Roosevelt said no, but Lindbergh got into the war anyway because he knew so much about aircraft that he was signed as a consultant to the aircraft manufacturers and say, okay, make these changes. And Lindbergh went out to the Pacific. He didn't try to go to the Atlantic, but he went out to the Pacific with some of the planes and he would train the pilots. Here's how you use them. And to show them, he would conduct some flights himself. And he actually went on some combat missions. This was without the knowledge or at least without the permission of the government. And after the war, after it ends well, Dwight Eisenhower, of course, was supreme commander of the Allied forces in Europe, brought Lindbergh back into the government and made him a brigadier general of the Air Force Reserve. So sort of at least by Eisenhower, and Eisenhower is one who, he had a big stake in this, being right in the middle of it. From Eisenhower's perspective, all was forgiven and forgotten, and Lindbergh was basically rehabilitated. And a couple of years later, he wrote his memoir, and it won a Pulitzer Prize. So by the end of the 1950s, Lindbergh was sort of back in the good graces of American public opinion.
It is a fascinating story. It just by itself, the two protagonists, as you say, and the argument about the importance of for this in American life, especially in the mid-20th century. But of course, the title evokes the idea that there might be something important from that moment for us in this moment today.
Well, I think that's definitely the case. And I will confess, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book when I did. So I had observed the first Trump administration, and I suspected that a presidency of Donald Trump would not hold so steadfastly to the Roosevelt ideal of American world leadership. And President Trump, when he was president, he certainly raised questions about America's continued commitment to NATO, saying the United States might pull out if the NATO members don't pay their own way. And he really challenged the idea that when trouble develops around the world, the United States needs to pay close attention, needs to get involved, that the United States needs to be the leader of the world. And many of the people who voted for Donald Trump clearly shared those views. So Trump lost, of course, in 2020. But when it became clear that maybe he was going to run in 2024, well, I thought, okay, maybe the time is ripe to take a look at this. I had long had an interest in this particular question, 1939 to 41. But the fact that in 24, it appeared likely that Americans would actually have this question on the ballot in a way that Americans had back in 39 and 41. Because between the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor and really 2024, there was never a presidential election where the two leading candidates, the nominees of the major parties, took such diametrically opposite views regarding what America's role in the world should be. Every Democratic nominee, every Republican nominee, from Franklin Roosevelt until Donald Trump, really 2.0, had taken the view that the United States must be the leader of the world. Now, there were shades of difference regarding what that entailed. But for the first time in 2024, Americans got to vote. And Vice President Harris basically took the position, we're going to be steadfast in leading the world and we'll continue aid to Ukraine and so on. And former President Trump took the position, well, you know, we might rethink these alliances. And voters had a chance to vote and they returned Trump to office. So at the very least, this means that this old question of what should the role of the United States be in the world is under review. And in on the whole, regardless of what one thinks about what the answer to that question is, I think that a country, a democracy certainly, ought to have this debate at least once every 80 years or so, because this is a really big deal. The interventionists, the Roosevelt side, they had been sort of coasting on their momentum from having won World War II and having been able to criticize the isolationists as they're wrongheaded. And every time somebody said, between basically 1941 and very recently, anytime somebody said, you know, maybe we shouldn't get involved there, then the people who did want to get involved would say, oh, you're an isolationist. And by calling somebody an isolationist, you could basically shout them down and shut them up. But you can't do that forever. You know, the lessons of 1940 or 1941, they don't last forever. And times change, and the arguments at least need to be revived and re-argued.
Well, you have done that in a first-rate, fascinating, page-turning way. The book is America First, Roosevelt versus Lindbergh in the Shadow of War, by our guest, Professor H.W. Brands. Let me highly recommend it to our listeners. It is a terrific read. You'll love it for the holiday season or into the new year. Professor Brands, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.